What if you considered all the ingredients that go into making a great educational experience for students? Well-prepared teachers, of course. Also instructional aides, counselors, school nurses, librarians, plus school and district leadership and staff supports. We'd need instructional materials, technology, access to a wide range of courses, and extra support for English learners, students with special needs, and others. And let's not forget professional development for teachers and staff, and school meals and transportation. If you added all these up, how much do you think California would need to invest per student to make sure we were providing a quality education to all? That's exactly the study that our special guest, Jesse Levin, principal researcher at American Institutes for Research, spearheaded. It's a landmark study that was part of a larger education research endeavor in California called the Getting Down to Facts 2 Project. Welcome back to Adventures in Ed Funding, presented by CASBO, the California Association of School Business Officials. In this episode, we explore the important and fascinating land of school funding research. How did Jesse's team tackle the complicated question of what makes up an adequate education? And yes, how much did they determine California schools actually needed to deliver on it? Hi again. I'm your series guide, Paul Richman. We talked with Jesse a while back in February, just before the COVID-19 pandemic. Soon after we recorded, we all began to recognize just how traumatic the health and economic fallout would be from this coronavirus. And to be honest, that gave us pause about releasing a story like this, especially at a time when the economy is reeling. On the other hand, it seems more relevant than ever, for context, to share this story now about the very real level of need in California's schools, even as we enter a time when state revenues will constrict. The pandemic has changed a whole lot of things, but it does not change these research findings. As a state, we were already falling far short of funding levels that our students need to succeed. Jesse, welcome, and thanks so much for joining us. Before we dive into the study, tell us a bit more about your background and how you found your way into educational research.
I was born and raised in California, and I'm really the beneficiary of some of the best public schools that California has to offer. So part of my drive is to try to inform policy that might offer the same opportunities I enjoyed to all students across the state.
Mm-hmm.
My doctoral training is in economics and in labor economics specifically, and I really became drawn towards economics of education by understanding that we make huge investments in what we call human capital, and one of the main forms of human capital is education, and it truly has the potential to transform individuals' lives. Now, the downside to that is when there are large inequities in investments amongst different populations of people, let's call them students or children. So I really saw that we could change the life opportunities of certain children by simply investing more in them.
And you do a lot of this policy research work, but you also have a connection and a stake right at home.
Well, so I'm the parent of two boys, 7 and 9, that go to school in the public school district. I live in Pacifica, California, just south of San Francisco, and I'm also on the school board there. So I get to see education through several different lenses as a parent, a researcher, and very close to the practitioners being a school board member.
And what prompted you to run for school board?
Well, in our district, everybody has a good story about getting sucked in. I don't think it was too hard to suck me in, but I was originally involved in spearheading an effort to get a parcel tax passed in our district. And after that, people said, hey, you'd be great for school board. Have you thought of running? And they didn't have to twist my rubber arm so much. And before you knew it, I was on the ballot and I was elected.
Uh-huh. And so this school funding study that we're focusing on, the one that you worked on in California, it's referred to as an adequacy study. What does that mean?
The real objective of any costing out study or adequacy study for education is to better understand how much it would cost in order to provide an education that will allow all students to meet some level of achievement. In this case, for this particular study, we used the California academic standards and also wanted to make sure that all students have access to an enriching educational experience. Adequacy studies are done, have been done all over the country over the past several decades. However, the motivations for these studies are quite different. I've been very lucky in that I've been involved in several different studies with different motivations. So I was involved in a study in New York, the New York Adequacy Study, which was really the result of a court case. And before any awards were going to be determined, they needed an objective study to really understand how much does an adequate education cost to provide and how should funding be distributed equitably to districts. In contrast to a court case, in California, this was really a proactive measure on the part of researchers. And part of that was really to see how much progress have we made and on a lot of the issues that were pointed out in the original Getting Down to Facts series of studies.
Now, just to fill in some more details here, Jesse served as the lead author on a team of six researchers who conducted the landmark Getting Down to Facts 2 study called Working Towards K-12 Funding Adequacy. He was also one of the lead researchers for the original Getting Down to Facts studies that came out back in 2007. Getting Down to Facts was a project that involved top education scholars from leading institutions across the country. A decade after that first series of reports, the nonprofit group PACE, Policy Analysis for California Education, a consortium of major education research organizations, undertook to revisit the issues covered in the original studies, plus they looked into some additional issues. All of that work culminated in the release of 36 new technical reports and 19 research briefs in early 2018, including Jesse's updated funding study.
So take us through a little bit, if you would, the process for the study. I know a lot of different people were involved, and you call it a professional judgment approach. So could you talk about what that is?
Indeed. So one of the main approaches to costing out educational adequacy is to use professional judgment. That is, we depend on expert educators. And the premise is that expert educators will know best what types of programming and what types of resources it takes to provide an adequate education. They are closest to the students who are being educated. So we go through a process where we recruit highly qualified educators from all over the state, and we assemble them into panels, and the panels go through a set of exercises. And the exercises involve building school-level programs from the ground up.
And these experts, they're teachers, administrators?
Well, so each panel, we do our best to recruit and staff the panels with a comprehensive cadre of practitioners. So each panel includes a superintendent, three teachers from each schooling level, that is elementary, middle, and high school, three principals from each of these schooling levels, an expert in special education, an expert in English learner education, and an expert in early childhood education as well. Finally, we round it out by pulling in a school business official for each panel. And this is the group that is going to deliberate what it will take to create an adequate program for a series of different school prototypes.
And as I understand, the research team sets a common goal or a benchmark, so to speak, for what every child would be able to achieve. And in this study, you use the academic standards set by the State Board of Education as that benchmark?
Indeed. So we looked at both the academic standards, what most individuals now know as the dashboard or the accountability matrix. And it's really this 5x5 matrix that shows for different dimensions of student outcomes. In rows, that is your status or the level at which your school or district is at. And in the columns, it shows your progress, how much you've changed year over year. So we try to take into account both the level and the progress. We want, obviously, all schools and districts to be very high on both status and either making progress or maintaining progress.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the academic side of it. But we also infused into this study the content standards, which are very, very strong. And these are really important to pay attention to as well. While these student outcomes that include academic standards, test scores on English language arts and mathematics, we also looked at graduation rates, and the accountability measures also have suspension rates in there, as well as English learner progress. Now, the content standards are really in place to ensure that all students have access to a well-rounded education, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
So the content standards don't only include things like ELA and math, but also include things like history, social studies, civics. There's a long list that I can read to you, but I won't. In addition, we want to make sure that students have access to humanities and the arts and things that traditionally in this country we feel are integral to a quality educational experience.
And I mean, essentially, too, it's if everything that you would want for
your
kids,
own child.
Would if we cost it out, what would that cost for every school to provide?
I think that is really it. We fall back on the content standards and academic standards that the State Board of Education has put forth, because that is what's written into our accountability system.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, if you just want to bring it back to the regular parent, it's really an education that every parent would want for their own children, including me with my two boys. So academics are very, very important, but civics are important, and social studies and visual and performing arts, things like music and drama, all very, very important. And I would be very disappointed if we could not offer those to my boys, and I think most parents would probably be similarly disappointed if they couldn't offer it to their children.
So the professional judgment panels agree on the overarching goal for students. And then what's next?
Their charge is to develop these programs that will provide the goal. Now, they're not just supposed to go and develop these programs without cost in mind. We drill into them that they should be mindful of several things as they develop these programs. One is cost. These programs should be implemented at a minimum cost.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we want the solutions to this problem to be efficient as possible. We also want the programs to be realistic. So they can't specify class sizes that are so small that they can never be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Third, we also want them to depend not only on their professional judgment, but on any evidence that they know of in the research as to effective methods or best practices. So we try to keep it very grounded in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it gets very interesting, because we give them the demographics of the typical elementary, middle, and high school in the state,
mm-hmm.
based on real data. So in terms of the student population, so the definition would be it has X number of students in terms of total enrollment. Out of that, Y percent will be socioeconomically disadvantaged, Z percent will be English learners, and another percentage will be special education, and we'll give them the distribution of special education students by disability category as well. So they have a good idea in their head of what the needs of the school is that they have to develop a program for.
Mm-hmm.
We start with the typical school, but then we say, what if all of a sudden the percentage of high needs students in terms of socioeconomic disadvantage went up significantly? again, we base this on the distribution of, or the incidence of, socioeconomic disadvantage across our schools in the state. If this goes up, how is your program going to change? Mm-hmm. And not only their program, but what are the resources in terms of the staff and the non-personnel do you need to implement this program at a minimum cost? We do a series of these exercises. So not only a higher incidence of low socioeconomic status students, but also a higher incidence of English learners, a higher incidence of special ed students. And in addition, we try to take into account that there are many schools that are very small, and particularly in rural areas. So we also do exercises where we say, okay, all of a sudden, your typical school has significantly fewer students. How is that going to change your program and your subsequent resource specifications? Mm-hmm. As an economist, it's my job to cost all of these out and make sense of these programs or the programmatic costs. And it's really with these data that we are able to project what an adequate education would cost for any school in the state. And that's exactly what we do. We do projections for every school in the state. Mm-hmm. And then we go through a series of aggregation where we add district level costs to these.
And so put us inside the room during one of these deliberations with the professional experts. Is there a big screen with data, laptops, flip charts? Are people nervously chomping on raw vegetables?
So the research team will be manning a laptop and projecting it on the screen. And we will have really the programmatic design document. And the researchers will really be acting as a scribe. And we have to get consensus amongst all of the practitioners as to what the program is going to look like. So at the start, it's really a lot of deliberations and then coming together, and then this is what they decided. For an elementary school, our program for the general education population is going to look like this. We are going to have target class sizes of X. We are going to provide, let's say it's high schools, we're going to provide counselors in this ratio of students to counselors. Mm-hmm. Our models broke up the program into a general education programmatic component, and then programmatic components for impoverished students, special education students, and English learners. But we also had a programmatic component for professional development, extended day and year programs, extracurricular activities, and of course, administration. You can't have schools without administration. So mm-hmm. the idea is you are building a school level program from the bottom up in the most comprehensive sense. Then we move on to what resources is it going to take you to get you there for each of these different school prototypes or exercises. When you get to that point where they're specifying resources, again, the research team is manning a laptop, which is projected on a screen so everybody can see. And if you type in one additional FTE teacher, the cost of your program changes. And we provide the cost, not only the overall cost, but also the per pupil cost. And it's broken out by each individual resource, and it's rolled up by programmatic component, right? So there's a lot of information there that allows them to make well-informed decisions as to the trade-offs of different programmatic components and how they might be able to deliver their program more efficiently. Mm-hmm. Right. And we're constantly drilling into is this the most efficient that you can be? Because one of the criticisms against the professional judgment approach, which is a valid one, is it could just be an educator's wish list. Right. However, we also try to be very transparent. So anybody can read through the report and go through the program designs and see that our panelists did an excellent job sticking to their charge and making sure that they were putting in just what they thought they needed and no more.
And about how long did these professional judgment panels meet?
Each of the panels sit for about 3 days with us. So
Oh, wow.
it's quite
okay.
A bit of work. Yeah. They do several exercises, as I said, approximately six exercises at each of the three schooling levels, elementary, middle, and high. And when I say an exercise would be your typical base school, high poverty, if you will, high special education, high English learner status, small school scale. We did a bonus exercise as well, which was really interesting. And that basically said, you've developed your model or your program for your typical schools. What would happen if all of a sudden your budget got slashed by 20%? How would your program change? So that was sort of our bonus exercise to really see. We call that our programmatic priorities exercise, right? And it's not too far from the truth when we had the Great Recession, right? Mm-hmm. There are huge cuts, and these are very real decisions that practitioners did have to make back mm-hmm. then.
So it sounds like a very intense process where some of the participants, did they seem energized by these exercises, or was it?
I think some of them found it challenging, but also quite empowering. It's not every day that that they're able to provide their professional opinion or expertise on what it truly would take. I think more often practitioners are faced with a budget constraint whereby they have this amount of money and they definitely have to prioritize how to spend a certain amount of money that is budget constrained. But this flips the question. This asks really, what is it going to take to provide the educational goal? Try to minimize your costs. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other question that they normally face is, you only have this much money, maximize how well you can do. And many may feel in their heads that there's no way they're going to be able to meet the academic and content standards, uh-huh. right? But they'll do their best to get as far as they can. So they're very different questions that are, I think they're being asked on a daily basis versus the question they're being asked in a professional judgment panel.
We're leading up to the big reveal, as in, what does an adequate education in California cost? But before we get there, Jesse, a few more questions. About how long did this whole research project take?
There were about six of us working on this project, and it was, I think this was all done in about 7 months' time, 8 months' time, something like that. So it was, this was a pretty intense project.
For you personally, was there anything that especially surprised you during any of the conversations? Any moments where you said, wow, I've never thought about something in that way before?
Well, I was pretty amazed at all of the deliberations, but some of the really interesting deliberations that I remember surrounded the discussion around provision of preschool. And there was just such a strong commitment that we should be providing preschool to all four-year-olds whose families wanted them. So it was basically universal. We made assumptions. Of course, we didn't assume that there would be 100% uptake, right? And we wanted to be realistic about our costs that we were estimating. But I was really surprised at the firm commitment to early childhood. And maybe that's because of a reference problem that I have growing up in California, where we don't have universal pre-K, right? Other states are making the move on that. Other things that were very interesting, I'm not sure if they're extremely surprising, but there was a call for more teacher planning time and a real call for what they call vertical integration. Teachers wanted to be able to plan not only with other teachers within their grades, but across grades, and really felt that they would like to have more planning time outside of the classroom to set this up. Mm-hmm. Other aspects of it that I was just learning so much were talking about English learners, and in particular, English learners that are new to this country and really have to be, for lack of a better term, integrated into the school, and they needed help. The special education population, there was an incredible amount of discussion of what special education students need, and the variation in the needs due to both the type of disability and the severity of disability. So we have many special education students who are mainstreamed and spend most of their time in the general education classroom and need just some additional supports there. And then, of course, we have more severely disabled students who need quite a bit more staff time. So I don't want to say that it was all surprising. It was really a learning adventure for me as well. And it helps me when I'm wearing my other hats, such as a school board member or as a parent mm-hmm. as well. So it was very enlightening.
Uh-huh. Well, and so this is the moment for the drum roll. Drum roll, please. What did you find?
Well, similar to the first study, we really found that California has a lot of investment to make if we are to provide an adequate education to all of our students. Specifically, we have to spend approximately 38% more on public education for K through 12, or shall I say pre-K through 12. This equals, and when I say equals, this is actually in 2016-17 dollars. So mm-hmm. This is a few years ago. But in overall terms, we're talking about $25.6 billion annually that we have to spend on top of $66.7 billion that we were currently spending at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is just an average statewide. There's also variation across districts in terms of what the projected funding shortfall was.
So some school districts are further away from the target?
Exactly. And so one way we cut it, which is very obvious, is by student poverty.
Mm.
And so what we found, we split up the districts into quartiles, that is, into equal buckets that each captured one quarter of the student population, okay, statewide. Mm-hmm. And we found, as you might expect, that the higher poverty districts were the ones that tended to have the largest shortfalls, that is, the largest difference between what we projected as adequate and what they were actually spending. And conversely, the lowest poverty districts tended to have the smallest gaps. Now, they still have gaps, or tended to have gaps, but they were much smaller. So let me just give you two examples. The average shortfall for the highest poverty districts in the state was estimated to be about 46%, okay? Whereas for the lowest poverty districts, this was about 22%. So there's a real stark difference there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, similarly, we wanted to cut the data by locale, that is, by degree of urbanicity. And we used very standard measures of this that are put out by the federal government. And so they will label districts as everywhere from urban to remote rural. Those are the two ends of the spectrum. And so the numbers here really showed that the more rural districts are the ones that had the larger funding shortfalls on average compared to the urban districts. The rural districts on average had a shortfall of about 46%. And the city districts, the most urbanized, had an estimated shortfall of about 37%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But because there's more kids in the urban district, the total amounts of money going to urbans are higher.
Far more.
But percentage-wise, the rurals are getting their...
Yeah,
would be getting their needed share.
Yes. So, mm-hmm. so one way to look at it is that, you know, in relative terms, the more rural populations have gotten the shorter end of the stick in terms of their funding shortfalls. But to make that up would not cost a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. That is, I think I quoted the $25.6 billion we would need to spend in addition to what we were currently spending.
Mm-hmm.
Only a few billion of that would be going to fill the gap for rural districts and small town districts.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Whereas a bulk of that $25.6 billion would be going towards urban and suburban districts to fill in their funding shortfalls.
So I want to come back to the total number. And I believe 38%, it would take about 38% more on average statewide funding to get to where we would need for adequacy, about $25.6 billion. When the study came out, and you started presenting that number and these findings, what kind of reactions did you get?
Oh, a lot of wide eyes, a lot of sticker shock, I'd have to say. So, of course, as with any quantitative analysis, you have to put the numbers in context. And where I landed on this was this number, while it seems really large, when put in the context of what some other states are spending, it's more of a reflection of how little California currently spends. So what I did was I compared the adequacy figures here. So, and let's put these in per pupil terms. It's a little mm-hmm. easier to think about in per pupil terms. These are $16-$17. So we had estimated that the current spending on average in California was a little over $12,000. And we would have to spend per student, mm-hmm. and we would have to spend about $16,690 or $16,680 on the average student to provide an adequate education. That's the 38%, mm-hmm. this difference between. Now, if you take that adequate projection that we had of $16,680 and you compare it against what other states were currently spending in that same year, what you find is that our adequacy projections were only like 2% below what Massachusetts was currently spending for that year. If you compare it against other northeastern states like Connecticut, New Jersey, Vermont, and New York, the difference between what we projected as adequate for California and what these other states were currently spending, the difference ranged from 15 to more than 20%. That is, our adequacy projections were 15 to 20% lower than what these other states we purportedly compete with were currently spending. When you put the numbers in that context, I think it's really showing you that California has not yet come to terms with what I'll call a funding crisis. I think there's no other way to label it.
Mm-hmm. And you, because you had done the original report, I think you said about 11 years ago, it must have been frustrating in some ways to come out with this report when we hadn't made much headway.
The two studies are not directly comparable, but my results show, bottom line, we're qualitatively in the same place. That is, we have to spend a significant amount more in order to ensure an adequate education. It's interesting. The original report, the main result there is that California had to spend at least 50% more. Now, in the Getting Down to Facts study, there was another study that used a similar method, but was totally independent from us. And instead of using professional judgment panels, they literally went out to principals and surveyed principals as to what they would need mm-hmm. to provide an adequate education. But the other study, and it was done by a great economist down at University of California, Santa Barbara, named John Sonstoli, his results said about 40%. Okay, two totally independent studies in the same ballpark, right? So if you're going 40% to 50% or more in the original studies, and then here we have this new study and we're down to 38%, it shows that we've made up some ground. Of course, the standards that were used for the adequacy goal were totally different. So it's not an apples to apples comparison.
Mm-hmm. And since that time, we have Common Core standards, which people believe are even more rigorous. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Uh-huh. So, you know, there's some sense of hope here that we've made a little bit of ground, but still qualitatively, it's the same story.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of investment to make if we want to provide an adequate education to all of our students.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you one question, because this comes up when you talk to public education critics. You were talking about predominantly some of the Northeast states that spend a lot more than us. A lot of times they'll point to, say, a state like Utah and say, well, they spend a lot less than you and their outcomes look pretty good. Is there anything... How do we reconcile that?
That's difficult. I don't know a lot about Utah. I do know that they're a low spending state.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can direct you back to the state that we always hear about or have heard about consistently in Ed Week over the last couple of years, which is Massachusetts, and they're consistently high on the NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress.
Mm-hmm.
And we've really looked towards, you know, Massachusetts. Our adequacy figures were only say 2% off below what they were currently spending. Mm-hmm. I don't see too many EdWeek articles about Utah's Utah's state education program being perfectly excellent, but I have heard that story before. You know, that they're not doing so bad,
right? And, well, and cost of living here in California obviously is dramatically more, right?
Yes. So this is one of the reasons why those differences that I mentioned to you are, those were not adjusted for the cost of living. So for some states, like, you know, the comparison between Vermont and California is almost certainly going to be larger, I would think, because our cost of living is so much higher.
So I maybe I missed that. So in the numbers that you gave, that's not,
those were
not yet even adjusted for.
No, those were California those were nominal figures.
Ah, okay.
Okay. Note that the numbers within California, those were adjusted for cost of living differences across districts within California. So that was trying to put all of the districts on a level playing field with respect to the cost of living. How much it costs to live in the Bay Area compared to Amador County, something like that. So we did control for those, but the comparisons that I did across the states, I did not adjust for cost of living. So it's, I painted a rosier picture than it actually is for most states. I mean, I think for New York and California, it might not be that much of a difference.
And you do a lot of research in other states as well. You don't just work on California. So this is something you have quite a bit of knowledge of, right?
Indeed. I mean, I've done adequacy studies in New York and in New Mexico, and also done evaluations of state finance systems for different states, Hawaii and Nevada, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So I get around a bit.
And does any state have the secret sauce yet?
I don't think... I don't want to say any state has the secret sauce, and state policymakers constantly ask what other states are doing and what works. And I think it's informative to see what other states are doing, but the ultimate question is what would work in your state. I don't think there are any silver bullets, and you can't just take what one state is doing and implement it. So I think, you know, California, we're going to have our own original and authentic policy discussions about how we want to approach adequacy. Now, the only other thing that I want to say is if policymakers come and say, this is far too much money, we can't afford this, then the conversation can pivot and shift to a very sobering discussion. And that is one of, are our standards too high? Now, I don't think any policymaker is going to want to go there, personally. I don't think our standards are too high either. So what are we going to do? Something has to give. You either have to provide the investment necessary to provide this equitable opportunity for all students to achieve, regardless of their circumstances, or you have to think about, are your standards too high? And maybe we're spending the right amount, but we're asking too much out of our system. You know, there's two ways you can go here. I know which way I want to go.
Jesse, you touched on this before, but there must be some critics or naysayers out there regarding the findings of your study. What would you say to them?
I guess what I would say to the naysayers is that these are the best estimates we have thus far. We have three studies now under our belt collectively that all point to the same direction. And when you have three independent studies, then you're really starting to build some evidence that there is significant underinvestment. I think that the evidence becomes stronger when you compare the numbers to what other states are doing, such as Massachusetts, who is spending a bit more than we projected was adequate and are getting very, very good results.
And if we were adequately funding our schools according to this study, What would that look like in terms of it? It might look like smaller class sizes, more bilingual assistance.
There were several themes that we pulled out of the panel deliberations. Mm-hmm. And so one of them was really to reduce class sizes. And they wanted class sizes to be at a reasonable level, but not so as to be inefficient. So there were no class sizes that were like, oh, it'll be 8-1 or something like that, right? But smaller class sizes, they wanted to make sure that there was focus on opportunities in STEM. That's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. They also wanted to ensure that there was this well-rounded education so that all students were offered visual and performing arts, or what's now referred to as VAPA. In addition, I mentioned this before, they wanted to provide preschool to all four-year-olds that wanted it, or families that wanted preschool for their students, for their youngsters. They also mentioned about engaging families in a meaningful way. So parental engagement was also really key, and they put resources in their programs to do that. They wanted fully inclusive special education as well, and that was very, very important to them. And then finally, they wanted to support dual language learners to really master reading, and that also seemed to be really important. So there would be additional supports in schools to do this. I want to be clear, this is what the panels thought would be the best use of these dollars. I'm a firm believer in local control and think that each locality should make their own decisions as to what their priorities are. But these are the types of supports that the expert panelists felt were important.
Well, Jesse Levin, thank you so much for leading us on this adventure through your important research. School funding touches so much and so many, which is why your work is so very important.
I'm hoping this is helpful to listeners, and I'm always interested in talking to anyone who's interested. So thanks for giving me the opportunity.
And that's a wrap for this slightly extended version of our show. Thanks so much for journeying along with us. We hope you've enjoyed this deeper dive into one of the most important California school funding studies around. Of course, the full adequacy report and dozens of other studies are available on the Getting Down to Facts website at, surprisingly enough, gettingdowntofacts.com. Adventures in Ed Funding is presented by the California Association of School Business Officials, CASBO. Tommy Dunbar handles all of our music, editing, and mixing. And I'm Paul Richman, your series guide. Until next time, be well. Once we get through this whole pandemic, I really think we need to take a road trip to Massachusetts.